A Heavy Weight is intended for mature audiences. This series discusses topics that may be triggering to some listeners, such as suicide and drug use. Some names in this series have been changed to protect identities. Views expressed by guests on this series are their own and may not reflect my own. Resources and source materials can be found on our website, aheavyweight.com. Thank you so much for listening. From the small southern Indiana town of Bloomington, this is A Heavy Weight. I'm Stacy Bradovsky, and I'll be telling the story of the unexplained disappearance of Joseph Smedley week by week. For the last year, I've been trying to piece together the last movements of Joseph Smedley, a 20-year-old Indiana University student who disappeared on Sunday, September 27, 2015. It's been about 6 years since Joseph's disappearance. And even for the people who were closest to Joseph and who are most eager to talk about his case and find answers, the details are difficult to recall. They're hazy at best. This isn't surprising. Imagine if someone asked you what you were doing on Sunday, September 27th in 2015. Would you be able to recall the day, to account for your time in a detailed way? Who were you with? Where did you go? What did you eat? What time exactly did you go to sleep? Even if something really significant happened, it would still be difficult to recall events with absolute certainty unless something or someone else could corroborate the details. In this case, everyone I've spoken with remembers the day in question as being exceptionally ordinary. I'm not a detective or investigator. I'm not even a journalist or a crime reporter, but I am a storyteller, and this is a story that needs to be told. I want to know the truth of Joseph's story because it's important, and because his family deserves to know what happened to him. As you'll come to see, Joseph's case was handled much differently than other missing students, and it shouldn't have been, because Joseph could have been any one of us. Joseph's story starts late Sunday night on September 27th, the night Joseph vanished. On that day, a supermoon coincided with a lunar eclipse to create what is known as a blood moon. The blood moon cast an eerie reddish hue throughout that night, a detail people have remembered years later, making the night seem especially ominous as people close to Joseph try to remember details from the day he disappeared. Sometime after 10:30 p.m., on the night of September 27th, Joseph left his shared off-campus house and disappeared. Joseph was a biochem and pre-pharmacology major, about a month into his second year at Indiana University in Bloomington. He wasn't a typical college sophomore. He'd overcome a lot of challenges to get into college, and he was pursuing an ambitious degree. His friends and family all describe him as smart and funny, with a really dry sense of humor. They also point out that he was exceptionally hardworking, determined, and responsible. Joseph made friends easily and was loved by those close to him, especially his two sisters, Vivian and Giselle. Joseph spoke with his sister Vivian often, almost daily. And when Vivian couldn't get a hold of her brother on Monday, September 28th, she knew something was off. 5 days later, Joseph's body would be found on the evening of Friday, October 2nd. His body was discovered by a local fisherman. Joseph was floating on the surface of a shallow portion of Lake Griffey at a local nature preserve not far from campus. The first page in Joseph's autopsy report concludes with this opinion. Death in this 20-year-old man is attributed to drowning. Alcohol and cannabinoid intoxication are interpreted as contributory to the cause of death. It would take nearly 2 months before the autopsy ruling would return, and it came back with an unexpected cause of death: suicide by drowning. To this day, his friends and family have never believed Joseph died by suicide. And there are so many unanswered questions and unusual circumstances in this case that I have to say, I'm not convinced he did either. Nearly 6 years later, Joseph's friends and family are still in the dark about the details surrounding his disappearance and death, leaving them with a question they're desperate to know the answer to. What really happened to Joseph that night? To tell Joseph's story in the way it deserves to be told, I need to back up to the years and days leading up to his disappearance to give you a better idea of who Joseph really was, what his upbringing was like, his complicated family dynamics, and his experience as a student at Indiana University. These details are critical to understanding the complexities of this case. Over the past year, I've sat down with Vivian, Giselle, and Joseph's father to learn Joseph's story, and for them to be able to tell you, in their own words, who Joseph really was. Joseph and his sisters grew up about an hour north of Bloomington in Indianapolis. Giselle is about 8 years younger than Joseph, so she was only 12 when her brother disappeared. Vivian is 18 months older than her little brother. She was around 22 when he went missing, and she's now in her late 20s, happily married with a new baby girl. She's devoted most of the last 6 years to pursuing answers in her brother's case. She's never given up, and it's thanks to her that I'm able to help tell Joseph's story. Being so close in age, Vivian and Joseph were really close growing up. Hearing Vivian talk about her brother made me realize that the best way for you to understand who Joseph was is to hear it directly from those who were closest to him. My first interview with Joseph's sisters took place just as the COVID-19 pandemic was beginning. So we sat spaced out on Vivian's porch on a sunny spring afternoon. Just a heads up, you'll hear some birds chiming in the background.
My name is Vivian Burness, and I am Joseph's older sister. Joseph was like a little boy genius. honestly, I was a little jealous because my mom was just blown away by how smart he was and always talking about him. I'm like, what about me, Mom? But he was just such a great kid, very, very sweet, huge heart, just loving and very determined from a very young age. And yeah, we played well together. We both had big imaginations.
And I remember one memory that sticks out to me the most is when Joseph went to, we all went to Jamaica together, and he had like this like coconut that he decided to open using his glasses as a magnifier. And so the sun would like hit the glasses a certain way, and then it would burn a hole into the coconut, and then he would just drink out of it.
That's we were so probably clever and smart.
Yeah, he was in first grade.
Giselle told me her brother always made time for her.
Yeah, so we would always hang out together. Yeah, he was very creative and very fun, and so, you know, I could come home and be like, I'm bored, you know, and he would just, we would go outside, he would find a random piece of wood, and like any kid that he came in contact with was just in love with him within minutes, you know, and so I think that's just kind of one of his really great qualities. Mm-hmm. He was had a very infectious personality.
Yeah.
And so everybody loved him.
Joe Sr., Joseph's father, also remembers his son as a wonderful brother.
Joseph was a very bright young kid. Coming up, he was great. He was always, he had a great sense of humor, kind of wry sense of humor. Nutty guy, always joked around. And, you know, through infancy, childhood, you know, 4 or 5, we just a great little kid. I enjoyed him as my son, was proud of him. He was the second born. Vivian was first, of course, and then just Joseph, and then Giselle. And he was a great big brother for Giselle. She loved him, still does. He was mischievous, of course, and as usual, big brothers are with little sisters.
By all accounts, Joseph and his sisters had a happy, normal childhood up until their parents divorced. Joseph was about 9 or 10 when his parents made the decision to split up. The divorce was really hard on him and his sisters. After the divorce, Joseph's mother, Lori, moved to St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, and his relationship with his father began to suffer.
My brother really just didn't had anger towards his dad during that time.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where their relationship started to split a little bit.
Okay.
Joseph had been really close with his mom, and after she moved away, he wasn't able to see her as often as he wanted.
And Joseph took it pretty hard when she, when we got the divorce and she left. And he was pretty anti-dad. But that was the beginning of him really developing a really dislike for his dad. Because he saw me as a culprit. So while he was at home, before he went to St. Croix, He just kind of had kind of a negative attitude. He was still smart and sharp. His grades were great. So I did the best I could. Mm-hmm. But Joseph was pretty turned off by me.
After his parents' divorce, Joseph asked his dad if he could stay with his mom in the Virgin Islands and eventually moved to St. Croix for a short time. His experience living with his mom didn't go as planned, and Joseph moved back to Indianapolis.
And he was homeless for a short period of time, living in the park down there, and wound up in the their equivalent of the Child Protective Services. And then they contacted me, and I talked to Joseph, and Joseph told me he wanted to come home. And I told him, I said, you can come.
By the time Joseph moved back to Indianapolis, he was in high school. His father had remarried, and Joseph's relationship with his dad became more strained than ever.
We were a little bit separated my senior year, his junior year. My family decided that they didn't want him to live with them anymore. I had a stepmother at the time, and she just wasn't that great. So he was actually staying with a different family at the time.
According to Vivian, Joseph became legally emancipated from his biological parents at age 16. And then he moved in with a close friend after the fallout with his father. The family Joseph moved in with didn't respond to requests to be interviewed for this podcast, but Vivian speaks very highly of them. They supported Joseph as he completed high school and were proud of him when he was accepted to Indiana University. Even after Joseph moved an hour south for college, his relationship with Vivian remained close. Joseph didn't have a parental figure to help guide or support him as he stepped into college life. And as Joseph's older sister, she helped fill that role for her little brother as best she could.
I kind of became more of like a guardian role for him in a certain aspect. I helped, like, you know, get his apartment and, you know, anytime. It was really more of like a, you know, check in, how are you doing kind of thing. And we send each other money back and forth all the time. Mm-hmm. Oh, and he would come and, like, for holidays, he'd come and spend, like, Christmas with me.
As he gained his footing at school, Joseph started choosing his career path. Vivian wasn't surprised her brother chose to pursue an ambitious degree at IU.
I mean, he wanted to be a neuroscientist at one point. I could totally see him doing that.
Even though he and his father weren't on speaking terms during this time, Joe Sr. still kept tabs on Joseph from a distance, checking in on his son's progress through social media.
felt pretty good that he was a, and I heard that he was a biomed student at IU Bloomington.
He was still hopeful he and Joseph might eventually reconcile their relationship.
You know, and I said, wow, that's terrific. In the back of my mind, I thought, you know, maybe when he grows up a little bit, gets a little older, he'll, you know, I still would love to have a relationship with my son.
But for the time being, Joseph was living a new life in a new town. And before I go deeper into his new life, I want to give you a little background about Bloomington so you can better understand Joseph's experience. Bloomington is the jewel of southern Indiana, a college town surrounded by limestone bluffs, rolling hills, and nature preserves. From May until August, the city is pretty quiet. It's the sort of place you're likely to run into someone you know anytime you go out. But in August, the city's population almost doubles, with more than 50,000 students flooding in to attend IU. The IU campus is beautiful and quite large, 4 square miles to be exact. It feels like its own city and even has its own police force. Bloomington's economy depends on the university's students and faculty, so in many ways, Bloomington is centered around student life. The main entrance to the university, known as the Sample Gates, opens up to Kirkwood Avenue, the main road that leads downtown, to an area known locally as the Square. The Square is a handful of bars and restaurants surrounding the county courthouse. It's really the only place to go out in town. Bloomington is small enough that most students can easily access the Square on foot from campus housing or off-campus apartments. During his freshman year at IU, Joseph lived in campus housing, but like many students, he moved into an off-campus apartment that following summer and stuck around Bloomington to work for a local moving company called Guys and Dollies. Without financial support from his parents, Joseph struggled financially as he adjusted to college life. He was under extra strain that summer because he'd chosen to pledge Sigma Pi, a popular fraternity, during the second semester of his freshman year. Greek life is intertwined with campus life at IU. With entire neighborhoods within the IU campus lined with dozens of enormous fraternity and sorority mansions, most of them even have full-time housekeepers and chefs. According to IU's Office of Sorority and Fraternity Life, Greek life at IU has a budget of just over $1 million for the upcoming year, and students' fraternity fees pay for close to half of that budget. It's a big business. While Greek life has been a stronghold of IU culture for decades, it's not without its downsides. You've likely heard of reports of hazing, underage drinking, and risky behavior associated with fraternities. Sigma Pi, the fraternity Joseph pledged, has been sanctioned for some of this behavior over the years and was recently suspended from campus until 2023. Vivian was surprised when her brother first told her he was joining a frat, but after talking with him, she realized that given his lack of family support, Joseph felt Sigma Pi was an opportunity for him to feel like he was part of a community.
I know I was a little surprised myself, but not super surprised because, like, he's just the kind of guy that likes to fit in wherever he can. And it's been that way since we left our private school and had to move to a public school. And I remember him struggling with just, like, that transition, trying to go from, like, this cute little smart kid to, like, someone who looks cool. And, you know, so I know that that's something he's always wanted, is to feel that acceptance. And so it was kind of surprising that he chose that fraternity, I guess, only because of all of the work that they were making him do. And I just didn't think that he would be the kind of person that would let someone tell him, you know, how to do things or, you know, boss him around. Like, he's just not that kind of guy. So that part was surprising, but him joining a fraternity, I guess, isn't like something that is beyond what he would do.
Pledging a fraternity, especially one like Sigma Pi, is a lot more work than people realize. the entry process is time-consuming, expensive, and stressful. Vivian was worried about the possibility of hazing and the pressure that Joseph would feel while trying to fit in.
I could tell there's a difference in it, like just his demeanor. When I talked to him over the phone, he's very tired, and he'd always be asking me for money because the fraternity would, when he was pledging, make him like be the designated driver, pay for all of their food, pay for pretty much everything for those who are already in the fraternity. I don't know why, but he just wanted it so bad, and so he just did whatever they asked him to. So I could definitely hear that strain, and you know, I remember asking him all the time, like, why are you doing this? Like, these people aren't worth it. And you know, he kept saying, like, once I'm in, you know, I'm able to, you know, have these connections. And you know, he's just very like determined to be successful. So
Joseph was determined to make it through the pledging process, and by the end of his freshman year, Joseph officially became a Sig Pi brother. By this time, most of his social life revolved around the fraternity, and Joseph had made a lot of new friends. One of them was a young woman named Jess.
So my name is Jessica, and I met Joe, I want to say my sophomore, beginning of my sophomore year at Indiana, maybe the end of my freshman year. I met him at Sigma Pi. I started going to Sigma Pi all the time because my freshman year, all the people that were on my floor, we were all really close. And two of those guys rushed Sig Pi. So all of us girls would go over there and hang out with all of them. And then, yeah, I met Joe. We became friends pretty quickly.
Jess quickly became Joseph's closest friend at IU. They'd study together often and spent their weekends hanging out with friends.
He was always like the person I could go to if I was sad or dealing with anything difficult. He was just always happy. Like I never like saw him down. Like if I did, it was just kind of like, it was kind of like a rare instance, but like when he was around everybody, like when he was around a lot of people, like we were at a party, he's the guy that just makes everybody laugh.
Joseph confided in Jess about his difficult family life, and they'd often talk about where they were headed once they made it through college.
I think given like his rough family life, he also like talked about like he really wanted to be successful in life and kind of like make a name for himself. I know he wanted to get into pharmaceuticals and like create medicine that would cure diseases. And he talked about that a lot, and he was super passionate about it.
Jess remembers Joseph as someone who went above and beyond for his friends.
Absolutely. I mean, that was him. Like, he would do anything. He would, like, always make sure I was, like, safe. I felt safe and I was okay. Like, he would, like, drop everything to come pick me up if I needed something. Like, when his frat was having a party, he would tell all of his pledge rides, like, oh, that's my girlfriend. You have to get her now. Like, he would always, like, make sure I was going to get picked up first. Like, even though we weren't dating, he just, like, always made sure, like, I was taken care of. And I think he probably was like that with a lot of people, like his guy friends, too. Like, he always, I think, just, like, wanted to take care of people and make everyone feel good.
At the start of his sophomore year, there was pressure from Sig Pi for Joseph to be living with his fraternity brothers. But Joseph couldn't afford to move into the Sigma Pi fraternity house. So when a room became available at an off-campus house shared by two Sig Pi brothers in early September of 2015, Joseph was happy to take it. Joseph's new house was located on Mitchell Street in Bloomington, an ideal location that allowed him to easily walk to classes on campus, as well as downtown to the square, in under 20 minutes. Joseph's roommates declined to be interviewed for this podcast, so I'll be referring to them by the pseudonyms Josh and Ryan throughout this series. Vivian remembers her brother being excited about his new living situation.
I vaguely remember having like a FaceTime with him, and he was showing me his new place, and it didn't like dawn on me that he'd like actually moved. He said that he and like two of his fraternity brothers had gotten this place, and he said it was a house, and he was just showing me around, and you know, I was really excited for him. But I had previously co-signed for him on an apartment, and at the time I didn't realize it was a co-sign. He told me it was just like a it's called a guarantor form, and he just said he just needed someone to prove that he had a guardian. So he was just like, can you just fill this out for me? I asked him if it was going to affect my credit, and he said no. So, of course, I'm still in college myself, so I don't really know anything about that. But I just wanted to help him out. So I signed the form for him so he could move into this apartment, which is where he was before he moved with the fraternity brothers.
On Monday, September 21st, Vivian received a call from Joseph's former landlord.
I had received a phone call from his old apartment, basically saying that he had vacated the apartment without finding someone to cover the rest of his lease, and that he was owed money for that. Like, I think it was like $680 or something. And they basically said, since I signed the form, I was responsible for it. So I called him right away. I remember I was like sitting in the line at the bank, and I'm like, what's going on? Why are these people calling me? And he had misunderstood. I guess he had spoken to someone at the apartments and said, he wanted to move out, and they said that they would help him find someone to replace him. So he thought he was okay to move out.
Just like Joseph, Vivian was a college student living paycheck to paycheck with not much money to spare. She wanted to be sure Joseph was going to be able to pay the balance owed, and he assured her it wasn't a problem.
I told him, like, are you going to be able to come up with the money? And he said, yes. So I was just kind of calling him really every day to check in and see, like, are you taking care of this? How are you taking care of this? And he said he had, like, an old, job, that like a painting job or something. And then he also worked for a moving company called Guys and Dollies. And that he's got checks that he still hasn't picked up since the summer. And so he said he was going to just take care of it with the checks.
Joseph's former landlord gave him 1 week to pay the remaining balance, which meant he needed to drop off a check by noon on Monday, September 28th. Joseph reassured his sister that it wouldn't be an issue, and that the only reason he couldn't take care of the balance right away was because his car was broken down, and he just needed a ride to pick up the unclaimed checks from his summer job. During this time, the week leading up to his disappearance, Joseph was also spending a lot of time studying with Jess for his midterms. To be sure that Joseph could pay the balance, Vivian was checking in with her brother daily. She spoke with him on Sunday, September 27th, the night before the apartment balance was due. Joseph again assured her that he'd picked up the checks and was planning on dropping them off in the morning after an early 6 a.m. class. That conversation took place on the day of the blood moon. Shortly after he hung up with his sister, a few of Joseph's frat brothers stopped by his house around 8 p.m. to see if they could catch a glimpse of the moon together. According to Joseph's roommates, Josh and Ryan, their guests left shortly after, and Josh, Ryan, and Joseph watched a movie together and went to bed around 10:30 or 11 p.m. that night. The next morning, Vivian woke up to something strange.
Well, so the next morning, I received this text message from him around like 4 a.m.
The text had come in at 4:15 a.m. Monday morning while she was asleep, and it read, "Viv, I love you. I'm leaving the country. By not telling you why, I'm keeping you safe and protected. Please don't try to contact me at this number. It won't work. I'll contact you once I'm set up overseas. Thank you for everything, Viv. I love you, and I'm sorry." At first, Vivian thought the text had to be a joke.
I kind of had a weird feeling, like, this is unlike him to send something like that. Because I just talked to him the night before, and we had, like, this deadline, and, you know, so I'm like, okay, maybe he's just, I don't know, like, I just thought he was joking, so I responded back to him, like, shut up, and make sure you turn in that check on today before noon or whatever. And so I tried to call him immediately, and his phone was going to voicemail. I'm like, what in the world? Like, why would he send me such a weird text and then nothing? I called him a couple more times, and it kept going to voicemail.
Vivian thought there had to be a logical explanation as to why her brother wasn't answering his phone. He had an early class. Maybe he'd left his phone at home. But as each hour passed, she started to grow more worried that something might really be wrong.
I waited until noon and just to see if he would, if the check was dropped off. So once noon came around, I called the apartments because I still couldn't get a hold of him. And I said, hey, you know, I'm just calling to make sure my brother dropped off the check. They said, no, we haven't seen him. We talked yesterday. Everything was fine. Now he's not answering. So now I'm thinking, like, he's dodging me. But that's also not like him because, I mean, he just doesn't make something up like that and then stop talking to me. And so I just was thinking, like, well, maybe he's, like, on a camping trip or something. Like, I don't know. I didn't know what was going on, so.
By Monday afternoon, she still hadn't been able to get a hold of her brother. So Vivian decided to call the Indiana University Police Department, and she asked them to perform a welfare check for Joseph.
Okay, I'm just going to call the police department and treat this like it's for real, you know? And I'm still thinking it's a joke, but I'm like, I'm just going to call them and, you know, like freak out and, you know, be really dramatic and then have them go and pull him out of class and so I can be like, what's wrong with you? Like, that's what I thought was going to happen.
IUPD officers went to Joseph's class, but they didn't find him there. They kept looking, and a short while later, on Monday afternoon, Vivian received a call back from IUPD officers, but they told her something she wasn't expecting to hear.
At first, they said that they found him and he was in jail. And so I'm like, what is going on? I'm like, okay, this doesn't make any sense. You know, it's just like, this doesn't sound like him.
And it's from this moment in time, on the afternoon of September 28th of 2015, that the story of what really happened to Joseph begins.
And then it just started getting really strange by that time.
On the next episode, I'm taking you straight into the search for Joseph.
And the fact that he was at Kersey Lake, and I'm like, he doesn't even have a car. Like, how did he get all the way out to
exactly,
Kersey Lake?
Exactly.
What police find and don't find only leaves everyone close to this case more confused.
It just was so strange that I was the only one that received a text message and that was the content.
I just feel like nothing's really adding up.
A Heavy Weight is written, produced, and hosted by me, Stacey Brodovsky. Edited and engineered by Joseph Caldwell. Additional editing, music, and sound design by Mike Brodovsky.